Our next story takes love out of the heart and relocates it to the brain. Would more people click if romance was a little more rational? Stay with us to find out. Hey, welcome back. So, what have we learned so far? That sometimes we click with someone because he or she is not what we're used to. A nice, open American girl to make us forget that stone-faced beauty we left blinking at the cafe. And sometimes we have no idea just what we're putting in motion when we set two people up who do click. But how do we know when love is going to take root? Love's reasons are as diverse and baffling as people are. Does the idea of romantic love set our expectations so high we can't even recognize clicking when we see it? Would love flourish if we listened to the heart instead of the brain, or the other way around? If we were more objective about who we choose, would we choose better? Two Stanford students investigate the mysteries of romantic attraction.
New Orleans, spring of 1945. A military ship drops anchor for a routine break from shuttling gasoline up and down the eastern seaboard. The crew of sailors disembark, gracious for their 10 days leave. One particular sailor, one of our story's two co-stars, finds himself invited to this ritzy party.
He pulled into New Orleans, was invited to a party. He didn't like parties, but he went anyway.
The guy is sort of standing around awkwardly, not totally sure how to act, so he decides to escape to the kitchen and help serve the food instead. There, amid the pots and platters, he meets a woman who apparently had the same idea.
So the two of them met serving the food at a party to other people.
Their son, Father Nathan Castle, now a priest, explains how, despite having only 10 days to get to know each other, it was more than enough.
And the war was on. Very few people had anything extra. So they window shopped. They went up and down Canal Street, the main business district in New Orleans, and they looked in store windows day after day, and they sat in a park and ate lunch and so on, and they just enjoyed each other's company. And when it was time for him to leave to get back on the ship 10 days later, he proposed, and she accepted, and they were married 3 months later, just months before the war ended, and they were married 52 years when my father passed away.
We've all heard countless versions of this story ever since we could first hear stories. Two people meet, and wham, they are in love. A short time later, they're married and proceed to live happily ever after till death do them part. It's the kind of love story we all want to play a part in. I mean, choosing a life partner sounds like a daunting decision, but all I have to do is wait until I meet the right somebody, and wham, does it really work out that easy? Well, with tales like these acting as our culture's ideal, our real-life love stories haven't always played out well. America bears the burden of the second-highest divorce rate worldwide, 54.8%. That means stepping up to the altar will result less often in a lifetime of love, and more often in tears, lawyers, and paperwork. Is following our heart's intuition the best method of choosing a mate? But I can't help falling in love with you. To understand how we pick our life partner today, we need to understand what brought us to our current approach, trusting our instincts. I recalled from a sociology class I was recently in, called Sex and Love in Modern Society, that today's popular approach was actually a rather recent development. I decided to ask the professor who's taught the course, Paula England, how motivations behind marriage have changed. She described how, during a good part of the last century, the motivations behind marriage were completely different.
In the old days, people were literally getting married when they were 19 because they didn't want to hold out for another, 5 years not having sex. So that's not a reason to get married now. Then there was kind of an idea that, you know, women aren't going to have jobs, so they can't support themselves, so they need to get a man to support them, and women's employment has made that less of a reason for marriage. So I think a lot of
she explained how, as the practical roles of marriage disappeared, the decision to get married or divorced rested more on the whims of the two people involved.
Maybe the rules about marriage are becoming less strict. It's like marriage is becoming almost like this luxury good. The practical reasons that made marriage a necessity aren't as much there anymore.
With our increasingly open-minded attitudes and plentiful wealth, American society is now safe for people to follow their heart into marriage, like Father Castle's parents were able to do in just 10 days spent together in New Orleans. And they turned out to be gloriously right. This seems to be the story we see everywhere. But as we've heard, the real stories usually don't have happy endings. Since listening to one's instincts doesn't seem so reliable, you might wonder if we have any idea what it is we're listening to. How do we know when what we're feeling is the genuine thing? Follow your heart, they tell you, and you'll just know. Learn to trust your instincts, those timeless romantics insist, or you'll never experience the real deal. If you've seen The Matrix, you may remember the scene where the Oracle explains that knowing you are in love, like knowing you are the chosen one, involves a leap of self-faith.
I'm gonna let you in on a little secret. Being the one is just like being in love. No one can tell you you're in love, you just know it, through and through.
Should we really place all our trust in something we understand so little? What does my heart know about what's good for me anyhow? Blaise Pascal once famously wrote, "The heart has reasons which reason knows nothing of." But it turns out that that hasn't stopped countless thinkers from trying to wrap their heads around what exactly it is that we're following when we're following our heart.
I started my professional activity as a neurologist.
In the late 19th century Europe, Sigmund Freud developed a new branch of psychology, one that would change the way we see ourselves.
I discovered some important new facts, psychoanalysis,
a school of thought in which a person is treated as a product of many unconscious forces. Freud noted that the relationship one had with one's parents in early childhood is the strongest of these forces and may serve as the model for later relationships. He observed that, with regards to romantic attraction, the quote, "choice for men, which is so strongly conditioned, is derived from the infantile fixation of tender feelings on the mother." This formed the basis of what is now known as parental image theory. The idea that your relationship with your early caretakers becomes deeply associated in your subconscious with feelings of happiness. And then later on, something about a person reminds you of that first relationship, and suddenly you feel strong feelings of romantic attraction.
It's a familiar melody that they're hearing.
Maggie Scarf, Yale psychology professor, therapist, and author of such best-selling books as Intimate Partners.
It's something they knew from long, long ago, maybe beyond memory, something from their childhood, something about that person that is special, and the specialness has to do with some forgotten memory. When I married my husband, he was an extremely quiet man. He's not particularly now, but I had a very, very quiet father.
Scarf explains just how life-altering our experiences of early childhood are.
First of all, when we come into the world, we don't know a thing, and the first things that we learn are very deeply impressed upon the central nervous system. English is your native tongue. It is the thing that is most deeply impressed upon you. It's your language. Well, there's a language of love, and there's a language of giving and receiving affection that is learned very, very early, and it's learned before language is learned, so that whatever happens early in life has a huge impression upon what follows.
So, according to parental image theory, we are subconsciously drawn to those who recall the image of our parents that was imprinted upon us during those crucial years.
The image of the parent, be it a good image, be it a true image, be it a real image, and that when we fall in love, that image is what comes to life again. Suddenly, we believe we're back in that first place of Eden, of perfection, of two are one. There's no difference between us. If I like broccoli, then you'll certainly like broccoli.
When we encounter this person whose qualities reawaken those deeply planted memories, we feel that giddy realization of the possibility of reclaiming that bliss, reclaiming that total security. Dr. Harville Hendricks, a clinical pastoral counselor and best-selling author, believes that parental image theory accounts for the most significant factor in who our subconscious chooses.
And this image is embedded in the mind, and this image then serves as a kind of template for the search for a partner when the template and the personality traits of another person match. This activates these memory traces, and that turns on the chemicals of the brain, dopamine. The dopamine high is what is that good feeling that comes with, that we refer to as romantic attachment.
Unfortunately, the idealized nature of this subconscious image must eventually come to terms with reality. There's a moment when you realize that the person you believe you fell in love with is only human after all. Maggie Scarfe has observed this to be a dangerous transition period.
When you start, you know, getting more in touch with reality, which is, I may hate broccoli even though you like it, that's when the romance starts to show its cracks, which is usually within the first couple of years of marriage.
In her time as a therapist, Scarfe has counseled many couples and noticed a painfully ironic trend among those who follow their heart.
At some point, the difficulties that arise in the marriage have to do with that very quality that first attracted you.
So those very same traits that gave you those first jolts of attraction often eventually transform into what specifically repulses you.
For instance, the very quiet, shy guy with a bubbly, outgoing wife will later on in the marriage redefine those qualities and say, what an airhead, she never stops talking, she yak, yak, yak.
This was an alarming development. I had merely suspected the heart of being uninformed, but well-meaning, maybe a bit foolish. This sort of behavior, however, came off as outright treason. It seemed clear that our subconscious does not have the same agenda that we do when it comes to mate choice. Sometimes they happen to coincide, but how I spend my life is something I prefer not to gamble with. Are there any other methods of going about this decision? To find an alternative, one need only look at the opposite end of the spectrum of national divorce rates. The lowest rate in the world can be found in India, with only 1 out of 100 marriages resulting in divorce. Sri Lanka, Japan, and Kuwait are also among the nations with the lowest divorce rates. What else do these societies have in common? They are all known for practicing arranged marriage. Dr. Hendricks comments on the correlation between arranged marriage and low divorce rate.
There's still arranged marriages, and there's a report from those countries that the marriages are stable, even though they are not based on romance.
Arranged marriage is essentially when the match is determined by one's parents or relatives. It seems that the desires of the heart are ignored altogether, yet the marriages so rarely fail. Is this only correlation or causation as well? Are Indian marriages happier than American ones? Professor England insists that they aren't happier. They just have different standards.
The more we have the idea that a marriage should be a real companionship, the more we have that kind of high standard, it probably actually does make possible better marriages. But it also means that when things get difficult, people have more of a sense of this is not okay, and they're more willing to leave.
It's certainly true that divorce is more accessible in westernized nations. Get a load of this commercial I found online.
Call 0800 078 9204 or go to divorceonline.co.uk to find out how you could get divorced for just £65.
So, according to Professor England, all this contributes to a greater willingness in countries like America to give up on a rocky marriage, whereas in countries with extremely low divorce rates...
It's everything about how people have less ability to be okay if they leave the marriage, not at all about the marriages are better.
What Professor England said certainly made sense, but I couldn't shake the feeling that there was more to the consistent success of India's marriages than simply a stigma against divorce. There had to be something that made these relationships more functional. I decided to interview somebody with first-hand experience with arranged marriage, a woman from my meditation class. I quickly learned that many Americans and I possess a rather archaic idea of what arranged marriage is really like. I asked her whether she thought there was a significant stigma attached to divorce in India.
Yes, it used to be at one point, but I don't think it is like that anymore.
So if the marriage really didn't work, the family would be okay?
Yes, if it really didn't work, yes. They do, but they do give their best to make it work. First priority is to come what may to make the marriage work. Yeah.
She now lives as an art teacher by day, meditation teacher by evening, and full-time wife and mother. I asked to hear the story of her marriage.
Well, 20 years ago, our parents introduced us to each other. They had to match horoscopes.
Uh-huh.
And so about 3 months prior to January, so 1987, they found that our horoscopes matched. So they said, okay, let's, arrange for them to meet and talk and then take it from there.
What was the meeting like? Well, they sat across from each other and chatted and...
Oh, we decided in an hour.
Within an hour, these two people who had never met before decided to spend the rest of their lives together. She said that while her instinctive attraction to her husband certainly played a part in her decision to marry him, there were many other factors that were considered.
I personally felt that way. I felt that there were a lot of other factors that were important to me, besides just that one person. The family background, I had a specific expectations of the family type, or the upbringing, the value systems. So after all of those things, then I looked at... my comfort level with that person. So it's not just only the gut feeling, but you have to look into other factors also.
I asked her if she had any thoughts on why the American divorce rate was so high.
I think there's too much of independent thinking. It's like people kind of seclude themselves and then does not allow anybody else to enter into their family life to give advice or give support or in any other way.
Western societies, especially today, are well known for valuing highly independence and individuality, which is definitely reflected in the way we marry. But with arranged marriage, it's like two families are getting married, not just the couple. The families do their best to support the couple, and she explained that this is a very important reason why arranged marriages are so successful.
The group support is definitely much more... it plays a very important and a significant role in supporting a marriage and supporting relationships.
Arranged marriage is based on such a fundamentally different philosophy that it can be very difficult for those from nations like America to understand it. But after this illuminating conversation, the other perspective easily made just as much sense to me as following your heart did. This is Professor Pierce from Hope College, Michigan, where he's been teaching courses on family sociology for the last 35 years. He spent some time doing social research in Japan, a country where arranged marriage is not uncommon.
I often propose that to my students, that I think maybe the calm and calculated ideas of someone's parents about who would be a good partner may well be wiser than those passionate ideas that two young people have about who would be a better partner.
Piers is suggesting that having an objective but knowledgeable third party choose a partner for you can be a very effective method. But given that our culture isn't about to relinquish the right to choose anytime soon, we are bound to marry someone we select at a subconscious level. Piers points out that All we need to do is acknowledge the unconscious forces with our conscious mind and reconcile any differences.
For instance, if I'm always attracted to a woman who loves to take risks, then I have to ask myself, while that's an immediately attracting characteristic, is this what I want in a long-term relationship? As we articulate the factors that make others attractive to us, then the second step is to say, and is this not just what I want today, but is this what I want long-term from another? What might the pros and cons of a long-term relationship with a person like this be?
A little critical thinking about our personal patterns of attraction that we've always taken for granted can go a long way towards years of happiness.
As I examine things, it gives me the opportunity to not only decide that, oh, this is who I'm attracted to, but also to evaluate those criteria for attraction and maybe change them somewhat. I might say, but I know that long-term that always leads to something not functional and happy, but something dysfunctional. So I have to consciously self-regulate, and I have to modify what seems to be my initial attraction.
Really, the passionate, instinctive marriage and the logical big-picture marriage both involved their own brand of deep wisdom. Perhaps there was some prudent middle ground option out there. Considering that Father Castle, who you'll remember from his story of his parents' New Orleans love, has presided over hundreds of weddings in his 23 years as a priest, there's a good chance that he had something worthwhile to say about thinking before you leave.
You ought not be engaged to somebody while you're so giddy in first love that you haven't thought through in a pretty rugged way whether you really want to do this or not. That's why we don't encourage people to get married fast. And most of the time they appreciate it. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just want us to marry them fast as we can, and other times we're slowing them down and saying, you know, we'll be happy to do that, but we first want to get to know you a little better and check out some things.
Now you will feel no rain, for each of you will be shelter for the other. Now you will feel no cold, for each of you will be warmth to the other.
Earlier today, I stood in Stanford's Memorial Church, where Father Castle presided over this wedding. But the visibly exuberant couple that stood before me did not meet by chance hiding in the kitchen of a party. Their first meeting was a deliberately calculated one.
Allow me to introduce our newly married couple, Paul and Elizabeth.
My name's Elizabeth Winchell. I'm the bride.
I'm Paul Brink. I'm the groom. We met on over the internet, a dating site called eHarmony.
Mm-hmm. Online dating services like eHarmony or Match.com have recently made huge gains in popularity. Over 40 million Americans use them. That's almost 15% of the entire country.
I've been fascinated, but I'm not even a student of online dating. And
Dr. Pierce explains how Americans may have stumbled into a method of mate selection that's closer to the ideal compromise between relying entirely on either the impulsive subconscious or the logical mind. Online dating services assess your subconscious with a method that relies largely on your conscious ability to honestly answer questions about yourself.
I've been somewhat impressed with a few where the questions, if answered honestly and accurately, would be really valuable questions for making an initial mate selection. In other words, when two people in this dating service at least would get together based on the mutuality or the similarities and how they filled out these forms, maybe that should be a first step.
They look for 29 axes of compatibility.
Yeah.
So we have to answer like 100 questions, and the first 90 or questions are actually about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
They're asking you to be very honest about yourself.
And then, as they do in the dating services, they get together for a few times.
We were at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco. That was our first date. Yeah, it was wonderful. It was such a great first date that when it was time to go home, we decided not to. We went for a walk in the marina and immediately started a second date.
After they've already sorted out these other various things, and then they say, oh, you know, there is something here. There is a kind of chemistry here between us. Or, even though we have a lot in common, there isn't chemistry. So if you'll excuse me, I'm going to look to my next possible partner.
Within the first few weeks of meeting Elizabeth, I knew it was going to be serious. And
yeah, it seemed to me early on that he was marvelous too. And when he introduced me to his dad, I knew for sure he was serious.
Piers doesn't see online dating as the solution, but as a step in the right direction.
And I don't think we need online dating services to do it, but they've already got it all computerized. And I think they may be onto at least a method of mate selection.
Have we been fed false expectations of what love should be? I've always believed that it was a virtually self-evident fact that love came entirely from within. I've always felt sorry for those in arranged marriages, pitying that they didn't get what they really wanted. But now I imagine my Indian counterpart across the ocean, pitying the close-minded Americans, running around choosing their mate blindly, obsessed with satisfying urges that they have no idea how to explain. To say who is right or wrong about any matter of love would be a futile exercise, for despite all the songs and theories and books, love remains a grand mystery. You don't need to understand it to have a lifelong happy marriage, just as you don't need to understand the machinery inside your car to get to work each day. Assuming that you do know the reasoning of the heart is undoubtedly a mistake, but let us never let that fact discourage us from trying to figure it out. There's a personal journey of self-exploration that each of us must undergo before we can know the right time to follow our heart and write our own love story.
That was produced by Art Tosbevorn and Stu Blair.